Joining me today on the Culture Kit, CEO and President of BMI, Mr. Del Bryan.
I got a hole in my pocket and I can't go to the fair. I got a hole in my pocket and I can't go to the fair. I'm blue 'cause I had a date to meet my baby there. When I don't show up, well, what am I baby do? When I don't show up, well, what am I baby do? She'll travel through the tunnel of love with someone.
Today's show is sponsored by our friends at ElectroVoice, makers of the RE20, one of the finest podcasting mics on the market. Check them out at electrovoice.com.
Joining us today on the Culture Catch, I'm very honored. We had a tough time getting this together, but you're a busy man, Mr. Del Bryan, President and CEO of BMI and a fantastic storyteller. Our listeners are in for a treat.
Well, I am Del Bryan. I am the president of BMI today. A great storyteller. I'm not sure. We'll try to tell a few and let the listeners judge.
Del, we met a couple months ago, and you were telling me some extraordinary stories about your parents and how they got into the music business, and they had started in a much different area of music. Share with the audience. What they were all about, because it's an extraordinary American success story, and you got to live through the whole thing.
Well, that's probably where you thought I was a great storyteller. I'm not an incredible storyteller, but I had incredible parents, and telling their story is a lot of fun, and it is an American success story. They were, I guess, the best handle they have or the best title is the first professional songwriters in Nashville, Tennessee. Now, some people who don't know about Nashville or songwriting might say, well, what exactly is so great about that handle? What does that mean? Well, the truth is it means quite a deal. Whenever you think of Nashville, you think of Nashville being synonymous, or most people do certainly, with music, but most people think of it being synonymous with songwriters. And it truly is. There are more songwriters per square inch or square mile or square anything in Nashville than any other city in the United States and any other city in the world. It is a songwriting mecca. And whether it's, I can't even come up with all the names. It could be Peter Frampton, it could be Michael McDonald, it could be Messina, it could be John Fogerty, it could be any number of people that have moved to Nashville or have homes in Nashville, one of the latest being Barry Gibb.
Right.
They come to Nashville because it's this mecca. And my folks were the first songwriters to come there to carve out that lifestyle that was one where a songwriter could make a living writing nothing but songs, not being an artist, not being a gas station attendant and writing songs on the side, but being a professional songwriter. There weren't thousands of them when they came. There wasn't one, and they became that one. So that's why that's an important distinction. And they not only wrote country music, they had Sarah Vaughan, Tony Bennett, Frankie Lane, Johnny Ray hits, Burl Ive hits, and at the same time they were having the Carl Smith, Jimmy Dickens, Eddie Arnold, Kitty Wells, Ernest Tubb, Hank Snow hits, and at the same time they were having rock and roll hits, Everly Brothers, uh-huh. Buddy Holly, Elvis, Ricky Nelson. So they began in Nashville. That was their base. They did it well enough and made it look attractive enough to induce a lot of people to make it their dream, and it became the base of many songwriters. And it's a songwriting town, and they helped build that.
Are there any stories from that time period, or do you have any as a youngster? A famous person coming over. How did the songwriting work? Would mom and dad wake up in the morning and they had a studio they'd go down to? I mean, you know, Music Row has these little recording studios you go into. I don't know if people know that out there. And, you know, people approach it just like you would any other job. You get in there and you start writing music.
Well, they didn't have there wasn't a norm at that point. As I said, they were the first, really. And although some people were certainly writing songs, most of the hit songs, even the country songs, came out of New York back then, little known fact. You had people like Von Horton and other writers who were good country writers, but they lived in the city. They lived up here. And you had a lot of the songs were coming from outside of Nashville. But my folks were family people, and we had moved to Nashville in 1949, and my brother and I came along. Thank goodness they brought us. We were about one and two. And they were very family-oriented, stayed home a lot, and they would have people come to the house. And my mom is Sicilian, and she was the best Italian cook that the South had ever seen. And they would have Italian spaghetti dinners and meatball dinners and sausage dinners and invite people, pour the wine freely, and then drag the guitar out, the songbooks that they wrote in, the ledgers they wrote in, and start showing songs. So everybody would get a full belly of the best food they'd ever had, get really loose drinking, and then mom and dad would just casually start the sort of homespun, home companion, prairie companion, whatever that show is,
yeah,
type approach. And then when they would find a song that the act liked, and this was right in the living room right after dinner, Dad would say, "You like that one?" We said, "Now, you sing this lead, and let me show you the harmony." And Dad would sing the harmony, and before you know it, we had an old Recco cut,
right,
that you could make the disc.
Right.
And then years later, a Wallensack, I remember, and the people would leave with singing the song themselves, with the demo of them singing the song that Mom and Dad had written, Dad maybe doing harmony and playing guitar. And you know, they had years where they used to get 50, 60 cuts a year.
Unbelievable.
And so they pitched songs at home. They had a publisher, and they, on occasions, did a lot of demo sessions, but they generally got, I'd say, 90% of their songs cut from live pitches after a big spaghetti dinner. And it used to be, their dinners were famous. People say, "Have you been over to the Bryant's house to eat spaghetti? You haven't lived till you've done that."
Got to have the gravy on Sunday.
Yeah,
oh,
so
man.
There was a story behind every dinner. I mean, we had everybody from, and I remember them well. I was a young kid, but I got a pretty good memory. But I grew up with everybody. I remember Jimmy Dickens when he was taller than me. That, if you're in the country business, that means a lot.
Right.
Because he's about 4'7".
There was little Jimmy Dickens.
And little Jimmy Dickens.
Right.
But through our house came everybody from the Burlives and the Johnny Rays and the Everlys to the Patsy Cline's and the Jim Reeves and the one-time hit wonders like Mark Denning, who did Teen Angel, which my folks were involved with, to the Sue Thompson's one, you know, Sad Movies Make Me Cry, or James Hold the Ladder Steady, or whatever, to the Jordanaires, to the Crickets, to everybody you can think of. Elvis wasn't there, but Colonel Tom was there a lot.
Colonel Tom, wow.
And people, we lived on the lake, so you'd see people like Eddie Arnold pull up in his, he had one of those 53 or 55 foot, I forget, Hatteras, biggest boat
right.
You'd ever seen on Old Hickory Lake, pull right up to our dock and get out and come in and listen to songs, you know. And
he was massive in those days.
I mean, oh, man.
My grandmother used to play me those records.
Oh, yeah, Cattle Call and Sending You a Big Bouquet of Roses. And Mom and Dad had a lot of songs done with Eddie.
Right.
Must have had five or six top 10 songs.
He was like the Frank Sinatra of country music.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then, of course, in the early 60s and mid 60s, he crossed over totally with Make the World Go Away and other things.
Right.
Not songs my folks wrote. Hank Cochran, a great writer, wrote a couple of those. But so everybody came to the house. I mean, if Robert Mitchum was cutting an album, he was there. He did an album of the folks.
Wow. I'd love to hear that stuff. That must be extraordinary.
It was great.
Yeah.
Everybody did records of the folks. I mean, and then you had the visiting firemen that would come over for a little soulful conversation with my father. He was known as the Buddha of Nashville and the guru of Nashville. He was never got a haircut at a barbershop. Mom always trimmed up. He had long hair. He had a goatee.
Did he really?
Oh, yeah, and he was one of the original bohemians, you know. He used to... When he was a very young man, he was into yoga and things of that sort early on. He was a member of the ARE, which was the Edgar Casey Foundation.
I love Edgar Casey.
In the 40s he was a member. He was
right.
He was into Siddha yoga. He was into every kind of yoga you could think of. He was a member of the early Yogananda organization. I grew up with a picture of Yogananda in the house. I didn't know who that pretty human was, but you know, so Dad was a heavy thinker, and whether it was Johnny Cash or Roger Miller or just anybody who wanted to have a deep discussion, Dad was up for deep discussion, and it was so everybody came to our house in my childhood and through my teen years, and I don't care if it was Christofferson or Willie or who it was, and
right.
They were there, and then of course in 72 when I went to work, I went to college, 66, 70, went in the Air Force, got back, worked for House of Bryant. Then 72, I went to work at BMI. It was just that continuous flow of those type people, many of the same ones that I'd grown up with.
Yeah.
And then an increased flow of new stars and pop stars and blues and every kind of star that BMI is involved with, which is really every genre of music. So my life has really been a continuous stream of creative people, and I grew up sort of understanding or knowing how to act around them because I was taught how to. I mean, when my brother and I were 2 years old or younger, I've had a couple of bars of soap put in my mouth and had them twisted. That's the way they used to teach kids to be quiet.
Oh yeah, I remember
because
those days.
When the light went on, when that red light went on, whether it was on a Recco cutter, whether it was on the Wallensack, or whether you were in the studio, when that red light went on, it was time to be quiet.
Right, right.
And I learned very early, and I had a brother, and we were less than 2 years apart. You know how brothers can get into it. But
yeah.
We learned very early that when the red light was on, it was time to be quiet. So we learned how to be around people like that,
right.
And then in the process really learned and appreciated the talent, and nobody had more talent than my folks at writing the funny songs, meaningful songs, loving songs, very bright, very tight, very well-crafted songs. And so it was an incredible education in American music, and it really set me up for everything that and all the opportunities that I later had.
Is there one song that you feel you relate to more than any other from that time period of growing up? Is there a song or an artist that related to your parents' songs, you say, wow, that maybe helped define who I am? Or obviously the whole thing did, but did you cotton to any one act or one song or a group of songs or an artist they were working with?
I loved Elvis. I loved Elvis. They brought the first Elvis album home when I was 8 years old,
right.
56. And it had one of their songs on it. One of the Dad wrote about three or four songs with Chet, and they were all really big songs.
Right.
And one was called "How's the World Treating You,"
right?
Which Elvis cut in the '56 album. That was called Elvis.
Right.
Of course, every one of them was called Elvis, but it was his second RCA, and it was a big one.
Right.
And I just fell in love with Elvis Presley, and I always wanted to meet him. I saw him play live three times, and. I remember listening to that album, and every time I would, the album, I forget if the first cut, but I think it was Old Shep. It might have been the second on one of the sides. And I used to listen to Old Shep and cry and watch myself in the mirror. And
my daughter does the same thing.
But that song just used to get me. But I fell in love with Elvis, and my folks got a couple of cuts with him, and I related to Elvis. But I loved singles. I grew up, it was all about singles.
Right.
You know, an album wasn't a real concept that was going to feed a songwriter. You had to have hits.
Right.
And it was all about singles, and I grew up highly motivated by singles, and the single was the best song on the album. It was, or at least it's the one you wanted. There may have been other great things, and my folks wrote literally thousands of songs, and some of my favorite songs were never cut, but it was always about the single.
Right.
And
so you guys probably had a pretty well-stocked jukebox in the house.
Well,
45s.
We had 78s. It
really?
Started with 78s, yeah.
Okay.
They started having their hits in the 40s.
So you had the 78s all over.
Yeah, everywhere. We used to, before they came out with Frisbees, we could throw a 78 further than most any other kid in the neighborhood, I guarantee you. We had a tree way out in the yard, and we used to throw it, and if you hit it, those things would just come apart, man. They would splatter. And I just loved everybody, but I love the singles. And some of the artists I really fell in love with that were friends of the families. I love Jim Reeves. He was a real, his nickname was Gentleman Jim, you know, but he was a gentleman. He was a great guy. We used to go bowling with his family, he and his wife a lot. And I adored Chet. Chet was one of my dad's best friends. He was a great guy, very, very real. And I really, really, really loved Roy Orbison, who was a doll who spent a lot of time at our house. My father helped move Monument Records to Nashville, really to Hendersonville, and then helped find Roy and everybody from Monument their first home close to where we lived in Hendersonville. And we had the pool and everybody hung out, and Roy would sit with the little gut string guitar and sing songs. Oh. We had a log house and hand-hewn logs, and we'd sit in that living room kitchen combo room, and his voice was enough to make you cry.
Sure.
My mom used to ask him to sing Mama, and he would do that. But I think one of my favorite cuts ever of any of my folk songs was Love Hurts, and it was his version.
His version?
Yeah, which was the B-side, A-side. It got a lot of play.
Yeah.
And it was a B-side, although it took off in a couple of regions, of Running Scared.
Mm.
And, of course, it was cut at the same time as the Everly Brothers, same month.
Really?
And theirs was an album cut. And the song ended up having a big life, but it really started with those two cuts, and people who heard it just loved it. And but his version of that song is my favorite, and that's probably one of my, if not favorite, songs, one of the top two favorite songs of the folks. So I was in love with so many of the artists and so many of the cuts. Mark Denning, the guy who did Teen Angel, was a dear friend of the family, and he cut a number of the folks' things. My dad really was highly involved with the production of those and bringing Mark to MGM. And Mark was a tragic guy who drank too much and had that one hit, though. And we had the B-side.
Right.
It was better to have a B-side in those days than an album cut because, as I said a few minutes ago, album cuts didn't sell, really.
Right.
And B-sides, you couldn't buy one side and not the other.
Right.
Of course, today you can with the downloads and whatnot. But we had a lot of B-sides in the family, and we celebrated. We were a celebrating family. I learned how important records were. And we'd go to bed praying that a song would break in, you know, Kilt in Dallas or something. I remember Dad would come and say, well, kids will know tomorrow whether it's going to go on the playlist on Kilt or WJJD. And if that happens, that'll really catapult this record. And it needs that right now. And we'd go home, we'd go to bed praying that that would happen. And so it was a family affair. And I honestly, and my brother, we both copped almost feeling like we wrote the songs because it was all done in the house.
Yeah.
And more than 100 times, I mean, it was the way it worked. We'd say, Dad, what about so-and-so? Show him that one. And it wouldn't be like we were talking out of place. It was someone like Eddie there or Jimmy or Dickens or Carl Smith or the Everlys or whomever. And my parents never excluded us, and we knew all these people. I was raised backstage Grand Ole Opry, hanging out with Hank Jr.
Ugh.
And I remember seeing his father hanging out in the back, and we were just all there.
Right.
So you didn't feel like you weren't excited that you were there. You weren't not excited. You didn't feel special. You didn't feel unspecial. It was just what was going on. You were a part of it. But songwriter looks for any reason to play the next song because he just doesn't want to run out of songs and he doesn't want to run out of an ear of an artist. And so if somebody comes up with something that sounds like, oh yeah, that'd be good, a writer is just dying for another excuse to play another song if the last one didn't stick.
Good point.
You know?
Yeah,
so
he'd
say, Dad, what about that? Well, yeah, that might be a good one. And so we were part of the process, and it was a lot of fun, and it was exciting to be in our household because our parents were doing some really strange things. They'd do these things at home, and then months or weeks or years later, you'd hear them on the radio. And
somebody else singing them, though.
Yeah, and that was exciting.
Yeah, that was exciting. Like, would you ever say, like, ah, I think Dad did that better or Mom did that one better?
Oh, well, sometimes they did, you know. My father was so sweet and so supportive of anybody. People would cut his records, and he'd always say, oh, I love that record. Oh, that's great, man, that's great. And later, after it didn't make it or whatever, he'd say, well, you know, it wasn't the best cut, but that's okay. I didn't want to nix it. I didn't want to jinx it. I didn't want to do this. But it's hard to get a cut. I mean, it was a lot easier in those days, but you knew that you were lucky to be in that business, and my parents specifically knew it because nobody else was doing it.
Right.
It was a blessing. It was a lucky thing, and they were thrilled. They loved the action. My mother loved it more than my dad. My dad was just trying to please her. You know, she really loved it.
The scorn of a Sicilian woman.
Yeah. And he was just humoring her. Okay, let's write another one. And then when he discovered that they could make money, he was highly motivated. My mother loved it. My dad did it for a living. And he was probably the more talented of the two, but if she wasn't driving him and pushing him, nothing would have gotten done, because my father wanted to play classical violin or jazz fiddle, and my mother wanted to be in showbiz.
Right.
You know, so it was a great combination.
Now, you went on after this to manage the catalog of the family, which obviously was enormous. How did you make the transition from there to BMI? I know you kind of skipped that middle step.
Yeah, well, I got out of Air Force Reserve. My brother got out of Vietnam. It sort of came together within months, and we went to work at House of Bryant. I'd been to college. He'd been to college. And we'd always been raised right in the heart of it. I mean, I made demos when I was 10 years old. If they needed a kid to sing something, I sang that part. If they needed a teenager and I was 16, I sang that part. If they needed a young girl and I was young enough, I sang that part, you know.
Castrata.
Yeah. So we were, and my brother always worked the control room,
right.
You know, at the point where we did have a home studio, not just a wall and sack.
Right.
So we were highly involved, and there was nothing in our childhood that inclined us to think that we would do anything other than go in the family business. And my parents were very bright, and they situated their copyrights in a way that they all returned to them. In 1956, they made a 10-year deal that stated that everything would return to them within 10 years. They'd gotten that approach from Frank Lesser, who had tried to get them to come to New York and write for plays, because my folks weren't just country writers. They were broad spectrum, but Dad and Mom said, but we've hit such a good look in Nashville, and we just can't give this up.
Right.
But he told them of the type of copyright deals he was making and how he was building his company. And my parents went back to Nashville and struck that deal. So in 1966, everything started returning, from Bye Bye Love to Susie to Dream to All I Have to Do is Dream. I said that Love Hurts, and just scads of songs. And a small company that they had independent in the mid-50s that they had turned over to Acuff Rose in this deal to be a 10-year deal. So the company grew out of that agreement. And in 70, when my brother and I were available to work at House of Bryant, we went into it pitching those songs. Really never had any thought that we wouldn't do something similar to that working with the family. And we pitched songs to anybody that listened. We knew a lot of people. It was a little awkward being Little Boudlow and Little Felice. I never was sure which one I was. But, you know, and people would humor us, say, oh, it's Boudlow's kid, let's listen. And then we read all the cheat sheets that said who was cutting throughout the country. And we had a lot of luck with who had been a friend of the family's and was a really great guy, Rick Hall, who started Muscle Shoals and really opened that up. He was cutting Donny Osmond and had that one Bad Apple and the Osmond Brothers and a bunch of success. And he was doing a single thing on Donny, who had some big hits. And we started pitching him some of the catalog, and he did Wake Up Little Susie, and he did Bye Bye Love, and he did All I Have to Do is Dream on Donny Osmond things. And we were starting to feel like we were doing pretty good.
Yeah.
And we had the family had had See There I Am with We. It felt like it was all one deal. We had had Rocky Top out, and the Osborne Brothers were doing a lot of the folk stuff, bluegrass. That had been a big hit, and follow-up singles included things like Georgia Piney Woods, and so we were a full-service publisher. We were promoting, so we would go to the state greenery and buy seedlings, pine seedlings, get the right paperwork, and put seedlings in paper bags and send them out for Georgia Piney Woods. You know, and then we had a muddy bottoms, and we'd send pebbles from creek bottoms out with the records advertising that. And
that's great.
My brother and I, here's a funny story, I
that's
think.
That's great.
My brother and I'd go on record, this was 70 to 72, on promotion. Dad would give us, a suitcase full of records. Say, you know, I think that we need some promotion in this, you know, we want you to go down through the south, through New Orleans, across through Georgia, up this way and around and in back in Nashville. Or we'd go straight up through Kentucky, up into Ohio, cut back into Wheeling, up through Baltimore, and then straight back home.
Right.
And we had all these different tours that Dad would help line up for us and set up the disc jockeys, and then we were eventually setting them up ourselves, what stations are in the path. And if we were going to do interviews at WVA or where, at Wheeling, West Virginia, I forget the call numbers exactly. And the first trip we went on, Dad had this big present for us. It was in one box. And we eagerly opened it up, and there was this beautiful briefcase. On one side of the handle, it had my initials. On the other side of the handle, it had Dane's. So we had our one briefcase.
That's it, man. That's it.
and we hit the road.
Right.
And my brother still has that briefcase.
Oh, that's classic.
And so my father had built a good relationship with disc jockeys and people around the country, and had a great rapport and the ability to really get involved on the phone and help break a record. And he knew all the disc jockeys, and he kept up with those people, and that we'd been trained that was the way to do it. And I'm sure that we got a lot of plays on records that were very secondary, mm-hmm. records that really never charted, that make 100 here, 100 there, 500 here, that would have a little life because we carried those records around. And
family touch.
Yeah, and that's back when publishers were doing that kind of thing. And today, of course, it's a different world. But it was a fun thing to do. It was a great way to learn the business from more than one side. And we met a lot of people out there hawking other labels and other stuff. And a lot of those people I grew up with ended up working with in other areas. So it was a fun two-year segue to BMI. And I got the job at BMI in a very interesting way. My parents' office, our office, House of Bryant, was in the Monument Building that my father had built for Monument Records. He said, you know, I'll build it if you'll come.
Right.
And they did, and we had an office on the second floor. It was a rather large building, and it was a fun place to be. I mean, I hung out with Dolly a lot when she was 17, or I was 17, she was 19.
Right.
Everybody who came through Monument.
Right.
From Christofferson to Ray Stevens, who had Mr. Businessman and all those things
sure.
on Monument, to Grandpa Jones and Boots Randolph, and just anybody and everybody who was on Monument. But we were working there, and that was only about a half mile or a mile from our home on the lake in Hendersonville.
Right.
So we'd go home quite often to the house, and Mom would make lunch. So It was a great deal. And so Dan and I are at the house having lunch, and the phone rings. My dad picks it up, says, oh, hi. Hey, how are you doing? Oh, yeah, Felice is here. One second. Felice, Frances Preston's on the phone. She wants to get us both on the phone. Why don't you go upstairs and get on the other line? So my mom trots off, and we're all there. And Dad says, oh, wow, let me ask him. And Dane and I are sitting right there. He says, I've got Frances Preston on the phone. She's wondering if either one of you boys would like to go to work for BMI.
Oh, man.
And I went, Dane went, not me. He'd just gotten home from Vietnam a year or so before, and he was still into fast cars and women and anybody that wasn't trying to shoot him.
Right, right.
But he wasn't into changing his lifestyle immediately. He was going to be a music publisher. He'd just gotten home, and he said, "Not me." Well, at that point, I was married. I had, you know, one on the ground and one in the oven, and you know, working for your parents can be a lot of fun, and it can be crazy too. And I've known a lot of second generation kids and a lot of folks that have worked for their parents, and parents generally aren't you know, known for overpaying. I think that's good. And our parents were into, like, learn the business and so forth and so on. So I had two kids. I was struggling. I was making about $100, taking home about $89. This is 1972. Well, I don't know. That might be interesting. It might be helpful. It might help us pitch some of these songs. Yeah. You know, it might be a good move for a short while. And Dad, that was how long I took. And Dad took his hand off the phone and said, "Francis, one of the boys might be interested. We'll call you back." That was it. Then, and this whole scene takes place in less than 3 minutes. Then I see my mother walking down the stairs from the bedroom quarters upstairs, and she's crying. and myself or my brother says, "What's wrong?" She says, "I'm just so proud. Francis wants to hire one of my babies." And then she really breaks out crying. She says, "And she doesn't care which one." And so, you know, Francis was a iconic figure in throughout the industry, but certainly in Nashville in the 70s. And to every songwriter in Nashville, she was really the real deal, and deservedly so. And so Dad said, "Well, Dell, I think that might be interesting." I said, "Well, yeah, you know, it's just hard to get into Billy Sherrill and all these people's office. And, you know, this might really be helpful to get a little credibility and learn a little bit more." And Dad said, "Yeah, and get that phone book worked up." Because to my father, everything was about a phone book.
Yeah.
You know, you had to have the numbers.
Man, yeah.
He had everybody's number. I mean, if he had a song for, you know, Marty Robbins, he'd call Marty. If he had something for Ray Price, he'd call him. If he had something for Roy or for Don and Phil or whatever, he'd just have them on the phone saying, "I got something. Can you come on over?"
Right.
You know, so it was all about the phone and your numbers. And I said, "Yeah." I said, "You know," he said, I was looking for his approval. He said, "Well, you know, for a year or two, get that phone book up and then come on back and we can really pitch some songs." And so I said, "Yeah, I'm in," you know. And so he called back, and this is, I'm telling you, the whole thing, by the time we got off the phone the next time, was 3 minutes.
Right, right.
He had Francis, "Dell's interested." And she had, I said, "Put him on." And she said, "Well, that's great." And she said, "I'm paying $300 a week, and you get a car and expense account."
You're golden.
I'm golden.
Yeah.
And I said, okay. And she said, "When can you start?" And I said, "Wait a second." I said, put my hand over the phone. I said, "Dad, she wants to know when I can start." And he said, "Well, you can start Monday." And this was like on a Thursday.
Right.
And I said, "I can start Monday." And I mean, I was 23.
Sure.
And
that's a big deal.
In 1972. I mean, I was changing my life, too, just in one phone call.
Right.
Quickly. And and so she said, "You know, we wear a coat and tie here every day. And, you know, I want to tell you that." And I said, "One second, Dad, I wear coat and tie. They wear coat and ties." He said, "Don't worry, we'll take care of that." I didn't own a coat and tie.
Right, right.
And so I said, "That's fine." She said, "Well, I'll see you Monday." And I got off the phone. That was it. I said goodbye, and that was it. She didn't speak to Dad or Mom or anybody after that. It was over. 3.5 minutes max.
Boom, you start Monday.
I start Monday. My dad called a haberdashery and Nashville, that he knew the people real well. Not that he was a dapper dresser, it's just that he knew.
You said he was a bohemian, so.
Yeah, I mean, he had one suit, a couple ties.
Right.
But never wore them unless it was award dinners. And so he put $1,000 forward and got me a suit, got me 3 sports coats, 6 pairs of pants, 2 pairs of shoes, 5 ties, a number of shirts, and boom, that was it.
You were off.
And he said, "That's what I think we need here. What will it cost you?" The guy said, "So-and-so." And Dad said, "Well, I'll send $1,000. The guy said, "That'll cover it." And I went. I went that day. I got started. I had my suits by there, or my clothes. They weren't suits. Sports coats and slacks by Saturday. And Monday, I walked into BMI, and Francis from her side, she said, I was really not sure which one of you I was going to get. I knew what you both looked like. I'd known Frances since 58.
Right, right.
And we'd been to BMI dinners. I was one of those teenagers that used to come with my parents to those dinners. Years later, I realized when a hot writer called and said, can I bring my kids? And you'd bite your lip and say, sure, glad to have them. So I'm sure a couple of lips were bitten when my brother and I showed up in our teenage years, but I knew the system.
Right, right.
I respected BMI. Hell, I was a BMI writer at the time I was 16.
Right.
Had a few cuts. But she didn't know which one she was getting. That's how I went to work for BMI.
Okay. So when did you make the migration from Nashville to New York to this office?
I was given the job in 1985 to work on the payment schedule, mm-hmm. because our payment schedule had become less effective than it should have been. We had made some changes in the...
You know what? Maybe before we get into this, there are people out there that don't know what BMI, what ASCAP, what CSAC do, why they're necessary. Do you mind just sharing that? Because I think it's, yeah. I think it's important that people understand how these organizations work and why they're important for songwriters, for musicians.
Yeah. No, I'd be glad to. BMI, ASCAP, CSAC, to far less degree. I mean, there are three performing arts organizations in the U.S., and between ASCAP and BMI, you really have 95 to 98% of the business. We are a performing arts organization. The copyright law grants creators a number of opportunities to make a living off their creation. You can make a living from mechanicals, which at one time were piano rolls, later became records, later became tape, later became CD, and so forth. These are all mechanical reproductions. You, of course, can make money off sheet music. You have two. You have now mechanical and sheet music, and there's no real order. You can make money off synchronization when they synchronize a song to a... It could be a commercial on the radio. It could be a commercial with visual on television. It can be syncing it to a song in a movie. It can be putting a song in a movie and having it sung live and so forth. You have a number of ways you can synchronize music, and so you have mechanical, sheet, sync. You have grand right. If you write a song like Ode to Billy Joe or The Gambler and somebody decides to make a movie about it, it doesn't have to be a song that obviously set up for this example, but it could be anything. But if somebody wants to make a movie based on that, they have to come to you, the copyright holder. They can't do it independent of the copyright owner, so they have to come to you, and you can say yes or no. And you have the right to charge, obviously, from that. And that's another way you can make money.
And there was a lawsuit last year with Steely Dan with Yumi and Dupree. Remember, they claimed that inspired that movie. I don't know whatever happened.
Yeah, I don't know what happened from that, but you can...
That's a good example of the old Billy Joe and the...
Yeah, I mean, and you have things like that were made into movies.
Sure.
There are a number of songs and things that have been made into movies. It's a grand right, obviously, if someone takes a book and makes it into a movie, or
right.
a player takes a play and makes it into an actual movie or so forth and so on. But a songwriter has that grand right, so now we've gone through four, and then you have the performance right.
Right.
And BMI and ASCAP represent the performing right. In the United States, you have all of these rights, and we only represent the performing right. In many parts of the world, certainly in Europe and certainly in Japan and the East and throughout most of the world, performing rights organizations also are mechanical, are related to, are in conjunction with mechanical organizations, and they represent the mechanical and the performing rights. In the United States, we purely, BMI and ASCAP, purely represent the performing right. So we are one of the, we are an organization that represents one of those rights. And what we generally do, I think it's safe to say, is represent many writers. And we bundle their catalogs, their works, into licenses, which we license to the users of music. And there are many different kinds of licenses. There are direct licenses, there are blanket licenses, there are a number of different kinds of options for licensing music from a performing rights organization. But we then monitor the performances, and then less overhead, pay the writers and publishers who own those copyrights for those performances.
Right.
That's pretty simplistic, but...
You did it much better than I could.
Yeah, but I think that lays it out. And the importance of performing rights are great because it's quite often the largest source of income that a writer might make on a song.
If you're highly involved with a specific artist
or you're a specific artist yourself and you're getting a lot of cuts and bygone days you had albums and you had a lot of cuts on your own album, your mechanicals obviously could be extreme. Or if you're a large writer and you had a tremendous catalog and you had huge cuts by huge artists, your mechanicals could be very good, and you may not have as many singles as you have overall cuts if you're a producer and you're getting a lot of cuts on people you're producing.
Right.
But quite often, your performance is your largest source of income, and it's certainly the second largest. People are very, very, very fortunate to have songs that fall great for sheet music.
Mm-hmm.
Examples of those might be a song like Wind Beneath My Wings.
Right.
It's played at every wedding.
Right,
you know, it's played at situations like that. My brother once published a song in his later life after House of Bryant, when he no longer worked for the family, called Could I Have This Dance? It was mm-hmm. an Ann Murray song, and it was a big wedding song.
Right.
And of course you have Christmas songs, and you can have specific type songs just like you can have songs that might lean be easy to turn into a grand write.
Right.
You can have certain songs that fall to sheet music. But performing rights generally would be the first or second largest source of income. Following that would be synchronization. I was speaking with someone the other day and they said, well, don't you pay for synchronization? I said, no, we only pay for performance. But after something is synchronized, if it's on television or on cable or on network or on satellite or any number of ways that it might become a performance, we're certainly going to pay for the performance.
Right.
But we wouldn't be involved with that synchronization fee. Another reason that it's very important and why it's the primary or secondary source of income is that it has not been tied to compulsory license.
Right.
As mechanical, which is either the first or the second, since 1909 to 1976, it was tied to compulsory licensing. Well, it still is, but it was at a set fee.
Mm-hmm.
It was 2 cents.
Right.
From the time there was piano rolls to the time there were, you know, 78s to 45s to even albums, it was always 2 cents.
Right.
It kept up with nothing, inflation or anything else.
That's amazing.
And so the copyright law of 76, which went into effect in 78, broke it out of that frozen 2 cents and allowed it to go in increments to more money every year and eventually to where it's at now, which is 9 cents, 9 points some odd cents.
Right.
But the truth is, BMI and our competition has grown even faster than that. The 9 cents, even if you, from 1909 to 9 cents, it's still, you know, it's just a little over four times that 2 cents, whereas...
I wish gas prices would stay.
Yeah. You know, that's not much growth. When I went to work at BMI in 72, we were making approximately $40 million. We'll close at above $825 million this June 30th. The reason that BMI is so important, or our competition, performing rights, is it has not been tied to a compulsory rate. It has been tied to the market.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been tied to inflation, and it's been tied to making a deal that makes sense,
right,
and to negotiating in the open marketplace for the true value of the music, or at least for a better value than a compulsory license has yielded in mechanical. So the growth of performing rights has also been so meaningful that performing rights has grown into the real juggernaut in a copyright picture. So that's another reason performing rights is so important. There are a number of reasons. Same thing has happened around the world.
Well, I was going to say, you know, and looking at a young artist, at what stage do you think, I think, you know, as soon as you're performing, you should think about it, if you have the talent, right? And you know you're going to be out there as a career choice.
I think, some of my views have changed, obviously, and I think I would be a fool and an idiot, perceived as one, if some of my thoughts hadn't changed over 35 years.
Yeah.
Now I still believe the same thing I believed then. No, I mean, a lot of things have changed, but there are a lot of things haven't. And I've told people ever since I started at BMI that first, if you have an opportunity for performance, you should be with the Performing Arts Organization. I'm obviously going to sell BMI as opposed to the people across the street.
Right.
But I would rather see you with one or the other than not at all, because you can't really handle that business. You can't go to the 5,000 or 10,000. At one time, well, I guess when I was there, started, it was maybe 7,000 radio stations. Now they're like 12,000.
Right.
But you can't deal
and
with
that's
those
not
stations.
Counting, is that counting the internet radios?
No.
No,
that's just radio. You can't deal with the 1,000 television stations. You can't deal with the thousands of cable. You can't deal, forget the thousands and thousands of internet license sites that we have. So you need to be with the Performing Arts Organization. Secondly, even if you're a little proactive and sign up with one before you have a performance, or if you're only performing live, because that's certainly a performance, it certainly adds a certain amount of credence to the other professional people that you're trying to start interacting with, whether they're publishers or other writers, creative types, record companies, to say that you know enough to know that you need to be with the Performing Arts Organization, that you're trying to follow professional steps in the business to properly get involved with the entertainment industry. There are probably people today that would say, well, I don't know that I need to do anything. I can do a lot of this on my own. I don't think that that's incorrect, but from a performing rights point of view, I still think you need a performing rights organization. There are a lot of businesses you can do on your own, and there are a lot of businesses you don't have to do on your own. We're one you don't have to. I think it would take you out of your creative zone if you tried to do the stuff that we do on your behalf. And the good news is, unlike publishers, unlike record companies, unlike any number of partners that are important and you might need in your career, we're not for profit.
Right.
We're going to do our business for simply the overhead. And then we're going to return that which is left to the writers and publishers who have those performances. So we are really, in the scenario, the honest broker. And there's every reason to be involved with the Performing Rights Organization. Maybe not BMI. Maybe there's another one that might, in your estimation, suit you better. But I would rather see somebody with our competition than with nobody.
Right.
Because we're the good folks,
right.
And I think that it's very important. I think we add a lot of value, and I think that we take a lot of worries off your plate. And we also are a good clearinghouse. We have a lot of services. We have a lot of educational services. We have incredible sites that you can go onto and learn a lot. We have seminars. We put thousands of new artists on stages each year.
Right.
We may not put the person who's listening to this blog on. We try not to be A&R people, but the truth is we have a play in that, and we like to have a play in that. We like to make a difference in a career, and we're doing everything that we can to help someone get to a performance, because once you start getting performances, we start having market share from that. And that enables us to go and sell those licenses for more and more and more and more and grow the value of the music. So we are really committed to trying to help people get to a performance.
Right.
There are certain people that are easier to help. No one's going to be more important in that process than the writer himself.
Exactly.
We can't do it for you, but we're incredible partners. And when I speak of overhead, our overhead now is under 13%.
That's pretty good.
That's amazing. When my folks were having their biggest hits in the 50s and early 60s, the overhead with BMI and our competition was in the 30s and 40s.
Was it
you
real?
Know, it's
wow.
It's slowly come down.
Uh-huh.
And
it's really streamlined the business.
Yeah, and
The digital world has to help in streamlining that. It's easier to control.
Well, I won't say that the digital world, I'm not disagreeing with you, but the digital tools.
The digital tools, right.
Yeah.
Because the digital world's a whole different discussion.
It's a little bit of a different, but the tools, technology, as it relates to tools, are indispensable in doing this type of volume appropriately, quickly, accurately, and cost effectively. So digital tools, you couldn't do this business without them. And I think BMI, without a doubt, is the leader when it comes to digital tools and a digital approach and systems. So there are a lot of reasons to be with a performing arts organization.
I know we have time for maybe one more question because you've got to get on. The music industry is rapidly changing the last few years. There's some who speculate the CD is all but, you know, going the way of vinyl. There'll always be people collect it. You know, digital music is getting better, I guess. The compression still bothers me personally. Mm-hmm. What do we do to educate young people about music? You said earlier it's all digital information. They don't feel that there's any intellectual value in it, but yet people don't steal books and paintings off of walls.
Yeah.
I mean, does it start with parents at home saying, hey, this has worth, this has value?
It obviously starts with education at a very young age. It's going to be a very difficult thing to educate people. Clearly, though, I think it has to do with educating them as to moral obligations, because it's going to be very confusing in the world that we're stepping into right now, because a lot of the new business paradigms, business models, are going to be free. I mean, they're literally going to invite people, whether they're kids or adults or whatever, to come in and listen free because of the ads they're selling.
Mm-hmm.
And if you watch some of the ads, you're going to be able to get this free.
Right.
There are, of course, those that models that it won't be free. It'll be a subscription.
Mm-hmm.
I think the subscription model is going to be immense. And I'm excited about that, and I think that many people agree with that because that's a performance.
Right.
And hopefully in the world that's coming, even if mechanicals go to the traditional type mechanical goes to very small and really diminishes, and not only does the CD diminish greatly, but the download eventually diminishes, that the performance will pick up that slack, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
and maybe even outpace that.
Right.
I don't know. There are going to be so many different paradigms that you're going to have a confused, you're going to have a multi-layered marketplace.
Right.
Some people are going to get it free legally.
Right.
Some people are going to still want to go out and buy it and have that physical stuff. It'll probably be a little bit older audience. It still loves the physical, loves to hold something. You're going to have a younger market and an older market, but you're going to have a lot of people streaming, and almost like the XM R-Sirius or Music Choice, where it's just all of that available,
right.
and they'll just turn on one of a thousand channels that's really specific and just listen to it and not worry about selecting their own. After they select the genre and the year frame they want or the artist they want,
they'll parameters just, you plug
yeah,
in.
Yeah, they'll just let it go. And then you'll have the people that are on a subscription that'll just wake up each morning and say, what do I want to hear today? And they'll pull it out. And then you're going to have the people, they're going to say, that's not for me. I just want my own collection. They're going to rip it, you know.
Well, I think the point you're making here is that there's so many selection possibilities. We've allowed the pie slices to get smaller, but we've allowed more diversification in all areas of the arts and all areas of your life, really.
Yeah, it's going to be hard to tell a kid, well, you can't do this, because he's going to come back and say, well, that's what, it's free and all I had to do was this.
Yeah.
It's teaching your kids that you have to play by the rules.
Right.
And my wife, she's bright, and she remembers distinctly and always goes back to that commercial on litter, where everybody was littering back in the 70s. There was just a horrid deal going on,
right.
And they couldn't stop it. They were spending hundreds of millions of dollars, and they couldn't get the message across. And all of a sudden, somebody came up with a commercial that had this incredibly beautiful Indian.
I remember.
American Indian standing there watching somebody unload their trash speeding down the highway. And all of a sudden, he was standing there, and you just see this tear.
Right, the single tear.
And that had a profound effect on littering. I mean, they could measure it. You know, it all of a sudden, littering just became about as politically incorrect and unpopular and really a bad thing as smoking does.
Right.
You know, I mean, right. You know, you walk by the front of a building where everybody's having a cigarette and some people look down at them like, man, look at them. Look what they're doing. You know, and littering became, because of that commercial, it really cut it down. She seems to think that there is a communication that hasn't yet been discovered, a message, not a communication in terms of new technology, but a visual, a message, a commercial, we'll call it. And I'm not sure that there isn't the proper approach to educate more and more people. Mm-hmm. I think it's a massive education situation. There is no doubt that if record companies and then the new paradigm for a record company and other people that are the impresarios of bringing music to the public and amassing talented people to try to find the cream of the crop that is going to be the quote-unquote hit, if they can't receive a remuneration for their effort, they're not going to go out and do that.
Right.
And I'm not sure that the public will be well served, and I'm not sure that every individual artist who's out there who's trying to get heard will be heard in the same way. I'm not sure that I've been raised around artists my whole life, and a lot of them have very healthy egos and push really hard and are incredibly successful or aren't incredibly successful. They're just artists that they'll always be artists that are trying and do or don't make it. And a lot of these artists aren't all that confident. They're that good. They're willing to do the work. They need to be pointed. They need to be aimed. They need a lot of guidance. They're very good. And some of them make it and some of them don't, once again. But those people, they need some of these aggregators, some of these people that come in and say, I believe in you. I want to help you.
Facilitators are important.
Yeah, and we can't let that process where somebody, so to speak, wants to go out and find a dozen of those people and quote-unquote throw it against the wall and see what sticks. There's nothing wrong with that concept. That was a concept that was somewhat defamed many years ago by talking about it in a way such as a label just throws it up and watches what sticks and then works with that. Well, everything can't stick.
Right.
And if you ever found that A&R guy who knew what was only going to stick, man, let me have him.
Few and far between.
Yeah, it doesn't happen. Yeah. So you have to throw some stuff out there and then start backfilling and really promoting and seeing what starts happening. And if we don't allow a place for that person who isn't the artist but loves to work with it, if we can't ensure that there's a safety in his approach and the way that he operates, you're going to have less of it. And those artists that aren't really driven to go out and make their own way, they're driven for their art, and they're driven to write it, and they're driven to try to communicate it, but they don't have the wherewithal to really open every door on their own.
Right.
I don't want to lose that guy.
Right.
And I am concerned. You know, the copyright law was written and it was enforced, and it has been enforced because it assists the general good.
Right.
There is a belief, a profound belief by the founding fathers and by the people that certainly enacted that copyright law in 1909, that there was a benefit to the population, the general people, by allowing people to be compensated for their creativity,
right,
that they would go out and create. And I do think that we'll solve these problems. I don't think that the digital world is spoiling everything. We're in a tremendous time of flux and change, and I think that everybody will, not every system, but I think the serious people, certainly the talented people, I think the real entrepreneurs, the song people, the business people who have all the right motives and all the right drives, I think we'll all survive. I think the business is going to get bigger. I think there's a lot of room for experimentation, and I think there are a lot of things that will work in the days to come that wouldn't have worked in the past, that couldn't have worked in the past, that weren't available in the past. And there are a lot of things that worked in the past that just aren't going to work in the world that we're entering and that we're in today. and that we will perceive tomorrow. But I think it's going to be good. I think performances are going to be excitingly high and continue to grow. And I think it's going to be good for the consumer, and I hope the consumer understands his role.
Very well put. And at the end of the day, there's a good song.
Got
to keep writing good songs, you know.
Dale, absolutely.
I want to thank you. You know, I know we could go another hour. You're a busy man. I really do appreciate your time, though, and your stories and your expertise and all of this. And we'll do it again. We'll get into
a
whole other chapter.
Yeah, we may just delve into bluegrass or something.
Well, we didn't even touch that. We didn't even get into what
anything.
We love. Mr. Dale Bryant, CEO and President of BMI, thank you so much for being on the Culture Catch.
Okay.
We'll see you guys soon.
Love hurts, love scars, love wounds and mars anyone, not tough nor strong enough to take a lot of pain, take a lot of pain. Love is like a cloud.
Yes, the great Roy Orbison.
Love Hurts.
Doing Love Hurts. Actually, that was Dell's favorite song, if you've just listened to our interview. And we started out the interview with Little Jimmy Dickens doing Hole in My Pocket. I'd like to thank Dell and the folks at BMI, and also our sponsor today, Electro Voice, for the finest in microphones. Go to electrovoice.com. This is Dusty Wright at Culture Catch. Converge is the word.
Culture Catch.